I always laugh at, I love when Latin restaurants where everything is corn-based label everything as gluten-free. And I'm just like, of course it's gluten-free. There's no flour here. Welcome to Rebalancing Act. We are Leslie Ann and Kieran, two law grads and friends. We know that climate change is happening and that we need to solve it. And that's why every second Friday, we'll be here coming together to talk about climate change, climate solutions, and what we need to do to get to those solutions. Thank you for coming along with us in our second season where we're trying something new. And thank you for joining us for our third and final episode talking about Earth. The next element we'll be doing in our element series will be fire. And we are looking forward for you all to being able to join us with that. We project a lot of things onto the earth around us. As a species, humans are pretty self-centered. We rely on the earth, the planet, the soil, for every single thing in our lives. But we project our own feelings, needs, and insecurities onto her. When preparing for this episode, I came across a poem. It's titled Complaint of El Rio Grande by Richard Blanco. And I'm going to recite it here for you. I was meant for all things to meet, to make the clouds pause in the mirror of my waters, to be home to fallen rain that finds its way to me. To turn eons of loveless rock into lovesick pebbles and carry them as humble gifts back to the sea which brings life back to me. I felt the sun flare, praised each star, flocked around the moon long before. You did. I've breathed air you'll never breathe. Listened to songbirds before you could speak their names, before you dug your oars in me, before you created the gods that created you. Then countries, your invention, maps, jigsawing the world into colored shapes. Caged in bold lines to say, you're here, not there, you're this, not that. To say yellow isn't red, red isn't black. Black is not white, to say mine, not ours. To say war, and believe life's worth is relative. You named me Big River, drew me blue, thick to divide, to say spick and Yankee, to say wetback and gringo. You split me in two, half of me, us, the rest, them. But I wasn't meant to drown children. Hear mother's cries, never meant to be your geography, a line, a border, a murderer. I was meant for all things to meet, the mirrored clouds and the sun's tingle, the bird songs and the quiet moon, the wind and its dust, the rush of mountain rain and us, blood that runs in you is water flowing in me, both life, the truth we know, be one in one another. Now, Kieran might laugh at me for bringing this into a conversation about Earth and climate solutions. Of course, Leslie Ann managed to make dirt political, which, yes, of course I did. The personal is the political, and well, you know I love dirt. But more than that, it wasn't me who did this. It was humanity. Plus, a guy on Bumble recently asked me if politics were really a deal breaker. I was flabbergasted that they aren't a deal breaker for everyone. So maybe I'm just feeling a little extra political this week. Talking about Earth and climate solutions has also brought up for me borders and immigration, conservation and land use, access to housing, and food security. The choices we have or have not made about how to use and rely upon the Earth around us has far-reaching implications. We have turned the Earth into something we fight over, kill over, and starve and segregate over. Take the Rio Grande, for example. We have turned a river, source of water for humans, animals, and plants. What could be providing water to agriculture to feed us? What could be providing electricity to support us? Into instead a sign of hardship, heartbreak, and death. A tool and a narrative in which those on one side of the river are worth less to societies than the other. I'm going to repeat this one stanza. You named me Big River, drew me blue, thick to divide, to say spick and Yankee, to say wetback and gringo. You split me in two. Half of me us, the rest them. But I wasn't meant to drown children, hear mother's cries. Never meant to be your geography, a line, a border, a murderer. This week, we'll be diving straight into an interview with Brittany, who's going to talk to us a little bit more about the connections between food security, farming, soil, and climate change. Brittany, can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about how you see climate change and food security being related?
My name is Brittany McGuire. I'm currently the Senior Good Food Program Lead at Meal Exchange, which is a national charity focused on food issues on post-secondary campuses, particularly food security. First of all, I think that they are really related, but honestly, I don't think a lot of people talk about it that often. As the first thing that comes to my mind is that climate change really threatens food production. We already know that the changing climate is impacting farmers across Canada, and it's going to continue to do so, there's no question, as well as around the world. We are experiencing changing and less predictable growing conditions. So in Eastern Canada, we are seeing, and the climate models are predicting, periods of drought and heat waves, which are longer and will be punctuated by heavier, more intense rains. And those things are already starting to happen. In the Maritimes, when I was working with a farmers network out there, we saw farmers trying to figure out how to deal with both too much and too little water within one growing season. In addition to the impacts on crops, heat waves increase the risk of heat stress and disease for livestock. So that also impacts production. Some areas are seeing things like unusually late spring frosts and early fall frosts, which can significantly damage crop production. And that happened a couple of years ago in Nova Scotia, where a lot of fruit growers saw significant damage to their crop production. Warmer annual temperatures and winters allow for things like new pests, diseases, and weeds that we haven't seen before. And obviously that's a lot to deal with as a farmer and threatens your crop production. And in addition to all of these variable weather patterns that we're seeing, climate change brings more extreme weather events like floods, storms, as well as sea level rise that puts farmland and infrastructure at risk. Extreme winds and storms, for example, have destroyed vital and expensive infrastructure like greenhouses on farms, and I've seen that personally. I would say the big thing overall is that there's just a lot of unpredictability, and that makes farming much more difficult and likely to experience threats to production. I would say that it's also just becoming much more difficult to be a farmer, and one thing that I don't think is talked about a lot is the financial risk and the mental health risk of farming in a changing climate. So all of it makes it much more difficult and decrease the production that we're seeing from farming, potentially. There's another big kind of chunk of this that I haven't even mentioned yet, which is that food supply chains are disrupted by extreme weather events, right? So like storms, floods, wildfires, all get in the way of food being distributed. So the food that we eat can travel quite a bit before ending up on our plates, right? So from farms to processing facilities to distribution hubs to stores, along each of these chains, they can experience disruption and decreases in food production, increased cost of farming and adapting to climate change, and the delays in food production, food distribution, can all lead to increase in food prices. So that ultimately impacts food security, right? When we have an increase in food prices, those are going to be felt by the people who are already impacting food insecurity the most. So all of these things together create a very difficult situation.
Are there ways that we can be changing our farming practices to be mitigating some of the effects of climate change, or to be adapting for what we anticipate the effects of climate change to be?
Yeah, so there are so many ways, and actually many practices that help do both mitigating and adapting to climate change, and ultimately make farms more resilient and ecologically healthy. And that's what I find the most inspiring or hopeful within all of this rather devastating situation that I'm talking about. I'm not a farmer myself, obviously, as I've said before. So the depth of my knowledge or lived experience implementing these practices is limited. So take that into consideration. But I'll tell you a little bit about what I've read and what I've heard from farmers who I've worked with. So one of the first things that comes to mind when I think about this is improving soil health and increasing soil organic matter, which can actually draw down carbon from the atmosphere and store it in the soil, which contributes to climate mitigation. There are many factors that impact the ability for soils to do this, whether it's soil type or specific type of farmland, region, type of farming practices, etc. So one thing I'm going to mention now and again probably is that supporting farmers to learn how to do these things on their farms is incredibly important because it's very complex and it's new information and some of it's just still coming out. But one exciting aspect of this is not only does improving soil health contribute to climate mitigation, but it also improves the resilience of farms themselves. So improved soil health can bring down carbon, draw down carbon, but it can also help improve water retention in the soils, which ultimately makes farms more able to withstand periods of without rain or drought, which I've already said that are going to intensify going forward. So it's kind of like a win-win scenario and probably many other wins when you're increasing the biodiversity in your soil, increasing the health, increasing the nutrients that are available. There are a lot of benefits, but it ultimately makes your farm a lot healthier. And there's a number of ways to improve your soil health. So as a whole, these practices are sometimes referred to as regenerative agriculture or regenerative farming. Some farmers are experimenting with decreasing the amount they till or overturn their soil to improve the soil structure through a variety of practices called no-till, low-till, conservation tillage. And each of those are different. And there's a lot of different types of practices associated with them, depending on the crops or regions and all that kind of stuff. Some farmers also are doing something called planting cover crops. And cover crops are planted specifically after a harvest to add specific nutrients back to the soil. And yeah, so you have like a crop that's for production, but you can also plant crops specifically just to add nutrients back into the soil, as well as to cover the soil from to prevent erosion and the leaching of nutrients. So all of these things ultimately make soil more resilient to the impacts of climate change, stronger winds and rains, and all of that's predicted to increase with climate change. So they're really important strategies. Another thing that farmers are doing are collecting and storing water on their farms. They're designing more efficient irrigation systems that reduce their water use, because both of those things can help prepare for drought and water shortage, which I've mentioned are going to happen more often. And farmers are also working to improve the actual drainage of the soils on their farms to decrease the impact of heavy rains on their soils and crops. This can be done in like a variety of ways, but some of them include putting drain tiles under their fields, which help with drainage. You can actually also contour your soils and fields to redirect water, and you can create ponds to then retain that excess water, which is great for times of heavy rain in order to redirect the water and not have it negatively impact your fields and your crops. But then also that water that's retained can then be used for irrigation during water shortages. When I was working with farmers, this is one thing they really wanted to learn more about, and people have a lot of information about this, but it needs to get out there and be shared, because these are all kind of new technologies. I mean, some of them are really old, but they're being implemented in new ways. You know, I'm sure you know that over the last how many years has been a focus on moving away from these kind of ecological ways of farming and more towards monocultures and really intense styles of farming, which is very different than the types of things that I'm talking about. And so I think it's in some cases, it's like a relearning or an unlearning of practices that have been encouraged. Right. So, yeah. it's interesting. And there's also some other small things they can do. So farmers can plant things called windbreaks, which are, can be just like belt lines of trees. And that helps protect soils, crops, infrastructure, everything from really strong winds, which are expected to increase. Another, the main thing that I think is really important is diversifying production. So if you're producing only one type of crop, you're going to be incredibly vulnerable to any risks or shocks that might happen. So diversifying your crop production can help withstand any shocks. You know, like let's say there's a new pest or sudden frost that impacts a particular type of crop worse than others. Farms are going to be more resilient if they have a bunch of different crops in production. So if that one crop was really badly impacted, they still are getting the financial stability from the other crops that they might have.
And so I think we kind of blurred into this question I was going to ask you a little bit about how do you see these changes relating to food security? But I imagine there's also maybe some more points to be made about that.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing here is that of all of the impacts climate change is going to have to farming and food production, they're all going to be worse with higher emission scenarios and climate models that are associated with those higher emission scenarios. So the worst impacts that we see in our food production and distribution, the worse that those impacts are, the more prices are going to increase, the more likely that communities will be cut off from supply chains and that food prices will increase. And that both short-term and chronic food insecurity will be worsened. So I think that's really important to state. And however, if we make our farming and supply chains more resilient to climate change, these shocks might be lessened. Also, there's, as I've mentioned before, there's a lot of potential in mitigating climate change by focusing on increasing soil health and carbon storage and decreasing external inputs that are produced using fossil fuels and contributing to emissions. So if we invest in and support farmers on a large scale to transitioning to more climate-friendly practices to decrease emissions and actually store carbon, become more resilient, we might be able to curb some of these expected impacts, which will ultimately decrease the risk that climate change poses to food security. Another important thing to mention is that sometimes people suggest that the increase in temperature is going to create all of these new opportunities to grow new crops. But ultimately, I really think that the degree of variability that farmers are experiencing within a season and from season to season will mean that the negative impacts outweigh any possible benefits from new growing opportunities. And for farmers to be able to even take advantage of these new opportunities, or to adapt to the rapidly increasing negative impacts, they really need a lot more support, and that's not even happening. So I personally don't see that the benefits associated with climate change are in any way going to outpace the negative impacts.
I really appreciate you bringing that up, because that's something that I've heard said, and I always just don't even know what to think about. But I think having talked to you about what some of those risks are and the amount of investment that's needed to even mitigate what we're expecting now, I think you're probably right that the potential to possibly grow other crops, for example, or to have potentially a longer growing season, you'd still be facing all of the variables that you are now just with a crop you're less familiar with.
Yeah, exactly. And some of those potential benefits that they're talking about are, you know, growing more fruit trees in Nova Scotia. But, you know, when I was there, I think it was 2018, there was a snap late frost. And some of the fruit producers that were in our network saw like 80% crop loss. And so I just don't see that, you know, even if we're experiencing warmer temperatures, which we can grow, means we can grow more fruit in different regions of Canada. That also means that we're seeing new pests we've never seen before, new diseases, new weeds. We're also seeing, like I said before, like droughts with really not a lot of water in between, not a lot of rains.
Yeah.
Punctuated by like more storms that are extreme, more really, really heavy rainfalls where it becomes difficult to manage the level of water. You know, I talked to some farmers before that in the Maritimes have never really had to deal with irrigation before because they always had regular rains, but now they're seeing droughts for the first time. And in some regions, even having like, you know, I was in New Brunswick and there was a risk for fire, which is like unheard of in the Maritimes, right? So I don't know that warming is going to bring all of these amazing new benefits. We're seeing all of the other things, plus potential for wildfires and disruptions to trade routes. And I could go on, but I just don't believe it.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I really appreciate you mentioning it because that was something I hadn't even thought to ask you about, but I really should have.
It's okay.
But I do like that this conversation seems very hopeful. There is a lot that can be done to support farming and to adapt and mitigate. And so for those of us who aren't farmers, do you see there being a role that we can play in this work?
Yeah, I definitely think that there is. And I think that's an important question. First of all, I really believe that the greater our local food systems are, the more resilient our food systems, the greater our local food system is, the more people that are supporting it, the more resilient they are going to be to external shocks like climate change. So supporting local food systems is incredibly important. And it also supports our local economies with jobs and on all levels, right? So production, farming, processing, distribution, sales, and all of these things ultimately contribute to the financial and physical health and cultural health of our communities. But it really comes down to the fact that people need to support local food economies, which isn't always the most convenient. Like sometimes it's more expensive. Sometimes you have to go out of your way rather than 10 minutes away from to the grocery store. But I think the benefits of doing that even sometimes are so incredibly important. And I think that it's really apparent when you live in a rural area and see that areas that have local food economies that are really thriving are just more vibrant places to live. And there's jobs associated with local cafes with local food or farmers markets or farmers organizations and all of the other things that come with these things. And so anyways, I really think that comes down to people supporting, to choosing to support their local producers, which ultimately supports the growth of our local food systems. I also think that if people choose to support farmers specifically who they know are reducing their environmental impact of their operations by, you know, some of the things we've talked about, like reducing the inputs that contribute to climate change, farmers who are focused on building up their soil health so that they can draw down carbon dioxide. So if and when people can, I would really suggest supporting small scale family farms, organic and ecological farmers, asking questions about these types of things. It's incredibly important in shifting our food system to be more climate friendly, resilient. We can't expect that our communities are going to be resilient to external shocks all of a sudden if we haven't invested in the local food economy first. And that requires the government support, but it also requires everybody wanting that, not only in their dollars, but who are you voting for? Are you asking questions about farming? Are you supporting agricultural policies when you're voting? Are you asking questions about climate change and food security? Like all of these are opportunities to ask for a more local resilient food system, which I don't think a lot of people are doing, you know? So something that I was thinking about too is that, like, you know, when I was working with farmers, I ended up, you know, making friends who are farmers. And I think it's really worth taking the time to learn a little bit about what farmers are facing and doing what you can to support them in those challenges. So maybe it's being more understanding if their crop availability is changing because of all of these, you know, unpredictable things that we just talked about. It's an incredibly difficult time to be a farmer. The other thing you could do is yeah, support your local producers, like cheese producers or whoever else, when you can, by going to farmers markets. You can also sign up for things like community supported agricultural programs, where you actually invest in a farmer either before the summer or the growing season starts, or you can choose to do regular payments and then receive a basket, sometimes it's weekly or whatever it is, but you're providing some of the capital up front that they need in order to invest in their farm over the season, as well as just providing like a stable customer base. It's incredibly difficult to plan how much produce you might be able to sell, right? And so a lot of farmers, especially small organic ecological farmers, rely on their like core customer base through these programs. So if you can and have the financial ability to.
Hey, Leslie.
Hey, Kieran. You know, how's it going?
It is how it is.
So this week I chatted with Brittany about farming and climate solutions and food security, and I'm really excited about it. And I think something that really stuck with me is the role that we as participants in the food economy can participate.
We need to stop not comparing apples to apples. Like an apple grown in, maybe not just an organic, but you know, like we are trying to figure out how to classify all these like climate friendly farming things, but it's not like you can find those in the grocery store necessarily, or to even discriminate as a buyer of food, you know, against food that's more friendly for the climate.
Absolutely. And that's one thing I was thinking a lot about when I was doing research for this episode, was how do I even find climate-friendly farmers? And I think that's something I want to think a little bit more about going forward, because I found a few, but there doesn't really seem to be a way to identify them, especially since so rarely are we buying directly from farmers. And I mean, there's even a question of who has access to buy directly from farmers that can be problematic around the fact that it's usually folks who are in urban centers. It's those of us who are a little bit more privileged who generally have access to farmers markets, CSAs, and things like that. So it's tricky for sure.
Totally. I do want to tell our listeners about one interesting, I think, new perspective. So there's it's sort of like a Silicon Valley-esque, I would say, organization or company called Indigo Agriculture. And the thing that I appreciate about Indigo, I followed them for a little while, is that, I mean, you know what Silicon Valley loves is scale. And, I mean, it works pretty well with software, and I appreciate that Indigo is trying to do scale with climate solutions, especially like physical ones. So Indigo has a few different branches of what they do. Some of it's selling certain types of seeds that are supposed to be more climate resilient, or you get better return, better soil sequestration. But the other part of it is this, that Indigo is putting forward, is the idea that food shouldn't just be a commodity, in the sense that if a carrot is grown in a way that sequesters carbon, and a different carrot is grown in a way that releases carbon into the atmosphere, those two carrots shouldn't be priced the same way. And we as eaters of food should be able to choose the carrot, if we so wish, that did help put carbon back into the soil.
I totally agree. And I mean, I think about the push for organic, and I think about how things are now being labeled as non-GMO. I think about the prevalence now of dairy-free, gluten-free, and vegan labeling. Even sometimes where it's not necessary, I always laugh at, I love when Latin restaurants where everything is corn-based label everything as gluten-free. And I'm just like, of course it's gluten-free. There's no flour here.
Oh yeah. The one that I've seen, I remember seeing, I forget what kind of random energy drink it was, but it was like an energy drink that was like, gluten-free, soy-free, lactose-free. And I'm like, yeah, because this is literally sugar and caffeine in a can. They're just hopping
exactly
on the train.
I feel like if we can get so into labeling that we can do that. We've got to be able to come up with a way to label and identify climate-friendly products.
I think the idea is that, you know, by giving consumers a choice on what kind of food that they're able to buy, that they're able to be a stakeholder and a force in the right direction. And also to provide support to those farmers that are taking new risks and trying new things, because farming is a really risky and intense business. And I think a lot of farmers feel like they aren't able to take that leeway.
Totally. I think that's so true. And it's something that really hit home to me in my conversation with Brittany, because she brought up CSAs and the way they provide really crucial funding to farmers at the beginning of the season. Because, of course, if you think about farming, the early part of the season, you have a lot of expenses. It's the end of the season where you're starting to have revenue come in. And so CSAs start to provide some revenue at the beginning of the season, which is when you need to be implementing some of these climate solutions, whether it be new seeds, whether it be new farming practices. And so not only can we talk about how are we identifying food that is already being grown in climate-friendly ways, but we as participants can also think about how can we support farms that we know are trying to work towards becoming more climate-friendly. And CSAs are a really interesting and really practical way to do that, as well as other forms of buying local from farmers, whether it be your local farmers market or buying directly from farmers and things like that, because really it's that revenue and the riskiness inherent in farming makes it really tricky to even implement some of these solutions, as much as they might save money down the line.
Absolutely. I think the importance of the revenue stream for farmers is really underscored actually by the recent farmers protests that we've seen in India. And at the core of those protests is the idea that farmers will no longer be able to have guaranteed minimum prices for their produce, for the food that they produce. And that turns a risky and difficult livelihood into something that is effectively almost impossible. If you are hypothetically, you know, maybe able to sell your product for your crop for a higher price, but also there's a chance that depending on forces that are truly entirely out of your control, you also might really get screwed.
Yeah. And it's something that, like, is almost heartbreaking in a way that we've come to this point where farmers are in this position in different ways around the world when we need food. You know, it's not something that our world can just get by without. And individuals around our world aren't prepared to start growing their own.
Totally. It's like so elemental that I think about sometimes the food that I eat in a day, and then I think about like the energy that I must take to produce all that food, and I'm like, wow, you know, I miss lunch and I am real grumpy.
And here we are not supporting those who do sustain.
Totally. And like, you know, the past isn't the end goal, but we can definitely make things better than they presently are.
Yes. I think we can.
And that,
and one thing that
that just really comes with, I think, transparency. It sounds silly, but so much of the position that we're in currently when it comes to climate are because we don't see how the world works and how all of these forces are really conspiring against change. And I think really lifting that veil and giving people more autonomy and more ability to make change in their own lives without it feeling like a sacrifice is so crucial.
Yeah. But I do think this is one topic where I really do feel hopeful about it. I mean, I feel hopeful about a lot of the climate solutions we talk about, but this one feels almost more in reach, mm-hmm. because it's one of the few that you can actually fix by throwing money at the problem. Mm-hmm. It's one where we have a lot of solutions that we can implement today and we are ready to implement, but farmers just don't always have the financial ability to do so right now. And so it feels hopeful in the sense that if we take away from this conversation and the conversation with Brittany what we've learned and incorporate it into the way we vote, the way we advocate, where we put our money, change feels like much more in reach than it does some other days.
Yeah. I think if we remember that when we hear agricultural policy on the agenda, it's not only not our problem, it is our problem and it's also our solution. We can do something about that, so we should.
I'd like to give folks a last opportunity. If there's anything you wanted to mention but didn't get to, feel free to throw it in. But of course, no pressure, because I know we did cover a lot of different things.
We covered a lot. I think, you know, I think the biggest thing for me, just thinking, the biggest thing for me is that I think these conversations need to be more integrated. Like, you don't hear a lot of people talking about food security and climate change. You know, I feel like I felt the pressure to work in silos and to talk in silos. Like, you know, maybe at work we deal with food security on one part of our work and then we deal with like food sustainability and another. But I'm like, yeah, those are so related. Or, you know, climate justice circles are talking about so many things, but they're not talking about food insecurity. Yeah. From most of the time, and they're not talking about food producers or they're talking about justice for livelihoods in the cities and urban areas, but not justice for rural livelihoods. Or I'll just say that I think that these conversations need to be a lot more integrated, and I don't know, I look forward to that happening.
Yeah, and I really appreciate you joining us for this episode to kind of show us that space and that interconnectedness and talk to us about how we can be considering farmers and food security in our climate work.